Hello and happy Thursday. My name is Katie Tizington Turner, and it's 5 p.m., which means you're listening to All Access Paz on CITR 101.9 FM. We are broadcasting live from the station on the unceded ancestral and traditional territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. We have a really interesting show tonight that will probably be carrying over into next week because we have so much to say on this topic. We are discussing sexuality and disability. So to give you a little idea of what we're going to be talking about this evening, here is a timeline of events for the night. We are going to open up with a definition and what we are talking about when we say sex and sexuality and disability. We're going to go over some of the misconceptions and the challenges to those misconceptions associated with physical and cognitive disabilities and sexuality. We'll hear a personal testimony. We are going to discuss a somewhat related topic of pregnancy and disability, and then we are going to discuss university curriculum associated with sex and disability. But before we get to all of that exciting content, we have a song for you called The Last of Our Kind by Rika.
Soldier, take off your armor, show me your heart. This is hard.
Welcome back to All Access Pass on CITR 101.9 FM. I'm Molly McAllister. So the first topic that we'll be talking about today is physical disabilities and sexuality, and we're going to start off by looking at some misconceptions and stereotypes. To start things off, we want to clarify, people with disabilities have sexual needs and desires that are no different than those of able-bodied people. And just like people without disabilities, those with disabilities experience their sexuality in diverse and unique ways. Unfortunately, a lack of information and society's misconceptions have led to many stereotypes about the sexuality or lack of sexuality of people with disabilities. A main example of this is the portrayal in media of people with physical disabilities as asexual and not models of beauty. The model of sexuality in mainstream media is that of a slender and fit, usually white-skinned, and always able-bodied individual. People with disabilities are almost always excluded from any themes of masculinity, femininity, or sexuality. Instead, popular images show people with physical disabilities as having poor quality of life and in need of sympathy, charity, and pity, not as equal members of society who have sexual needs and desires or who are sexually attractive. This very narrow view of sexuality has conditioned society to hold misconceptions about sex and disability and has created really problematic stereotypes. Our following examples include terminology that is disrespectful, inaccurate, prejudiced, and that we do not condone the use of it. Rather, we have decided to use these phrases to emphasize the importance of getting rid of these stereotypes and in turn breaking down social barriers. So Deepi's going to take over and she's going to give those examples for us.
Our first example is when people with disabilities are looked as the bitter cripple. As someone who is angry and bitter about having a disability, this emphasizes on negativity and inability, leaves no space for expression of sexuality, beauty, and individuality. A second example is the inspirational hero stereotype. A person with a physical disability is seen to have overcome struggles with great courage and bravery. This image is often used by the media in comparison to Christopher Reeves. This stereotype is often perpetuated by people who have really good intentions, making it really popular in media and entertainment, but nevertheless still problematic. The emphasis is not on someone's personality, sexuality, or individuality, but instead assumes that person's disability is a negative component of their life, something to be ashamed of or to struggle with, and not as something that is part of who they are as a dynamic human being. This can encourage a response of pity and sympathy, both of which are not conducive with being celebrated as a sexual human being. A third example is the stereotype of sickness and disease. Viewing someone with a disability as a sick or suffering and treating the sickness as something to be cured. Rather, we think that a disability is not a sickness and can actually positively contribute to someone's unique expression of sexuality and experience in sexual relationships. These stereotypes contribute to assumptions concluding that people with disabilities are asexual, that they aren't able to engage in sexual acts or relationships, and that they don't have the same desires as anyone else. These assumptions can lead to social and cultural exclusion. However, these stereotypes are slowly beginning to dissolve, and more useful resources are becoming available to help educate people and to provide services to help with disabilities. These include internet resources, peer groups, educational consulting, workplace awareness training, new dating organizations and business that provide sex services for people of all abilities.
Following those examples from DP, we wanted to provide you with a lived experience narrative. The following is a personal reflection from an individual who has a physical disability. They chose to share their experience with us anonymously. Our long-term silent member, Matt, will be reading this person's narrative.
Sex has never come easy. Growing up with a severe disability has really limited my options for partners. There's parts of me that aren't the least bit concerned about this, but as you pass your teens and into your 20s, sex is in your face and a major selling point in our culture. If you're not having it, you feel like you're doing something wrong. As I explored my options and looked for partners, sexual surrogacy came to the forefront as the most viable solution and one that I wanted to explore after I saw the 2012 film The Session. My city had a few options. After speaking with an organization that deals with peer counseling specializing in this area, I found a sexual therapy organization that met my needs. It wasn't cheap. It was over $200 just for 1 hour, but it was hard for me to put a price on human physical touch that I hadn't experienced before. Being on a fixed income, that money wasn't easy to come by and I had to save up. I felt like a child saving up for a video game, except I was now an adult. The longer I waited to save up, the more I wanted it. It was soon after that I realized I needed to find an appropriate venue to host the occasion. My living arrangements weren't ideal to host, and I needed to find something. Is this what it feels like to be a teenager and fool around? Is this what I had been missing? A hotel would cost an additional $80. How could something so pure and human cost so much? After booking a hotel, waiting became equal parts throbbing anticipation and terrifying concerns thinking about what could go wrong. When the day finally arrived, it was January during a long winter, but today was different. It felt like spring. Arriving to the hotel downtown, I was filled with nerves. I knew what I was doing was breaking social mores, but it was society that had pushed me to this point. I couldn't back out. So much of post-pubescent life was based around this. Checking into the hotel was an experience I wouldn't forget. The counter staff was exceptionally friendly, making sure that I could fit my wheelchair into their 100-year-old elevator and was able to move around the cramped quarters of the room. I felt guilty knowing that what I was doing in this room was for only 2 hours, and then I would leave promptly, hoping not to arouse suspicion. It's hard to just slip into the night when you drive a power chair and require a support worker with you at all times. The desk clerk was making small talk with me, and I could sense something when she noticed my address wasn't that far from where I was checking in. I came up with a lie that my current house was undergoing reservations and just needed a place to stay for the night. Once I checked into the room, I called the madam to let her know I had arrived and where I was staying, room 402. The woman I was meeting managed to get an entry into the hotel without my assistance, slightly relieving me. My support worker answered the door, resulting in an important and impromptu meeting. While both parties met, I could only awkwardly lie in bed and watch. I had never felt as vulnerable as I did then. I did not expect this. She starts with some simple stretching of my limbs, then it turns into a massage. Then oils are applied. It's a mixed sensation of practical therapy to my body and an intimate touch. Music starts being played, and I lose myself. Time was up before we have time to even think. We make small talk as I wait for my support worker to return and put me back in my chair. I still can't comprehend what happens, and I'm filled with many emotions. My hair is disheveled, my body is sweaty, my muscles hurt in a way I've never felt before. The room has a strange smell. There was glitter in the bed where a body was just minutes ago. I feel naked. This is what the years of mystery was holding back? On the ride home, I'm reflecting what just occurred. I am forever grateful for a service like this exists, yet I feel dirty, used, conflicted. Is this normal? Is this what sex is? Will I ever know? I guess I'll have to wait up and save and try again in a few months.
Up next, we're going to play a song for you. This is Cannons by Little Scream Off. ¶¶
What do you know about bikes? Everything? Perfect. Nothing at all? Even better. At the UBC Bike Kitchen, you can use our space and tools to do your own bike maintenance, get one-on-one instruction on how to fix your bike yourself, or drop your bike off for us to repair. You can also buy a fully refurbished, guaranteed used bicycle, or a variety of new and used parts and accessories. The Bike Kitchen is UBC's non-profit, student-owned, full-service bike shop. We're located in the basement of the Student Union Building. Just look for the stairwell on the north side of the sub across from Gage Towers, or search for the UBC Bike Kitchen on Facebook. Stop by the Bike Kitchen and then get riding.
The unexpected, as phenomenal musicians perform magic over three nights at the third annual Improvised Music Meeting. This year, Vancouver's finest improvisers meet Toronto-based trumpeter-composer Lena Alemano and Seattle-based vocalist-composer Robin Holcomb.
Don't tell me a story.
Vancouver Improvised Music Meeting, March 24th at China Cloud. March 25th and 26th at Western Front. For more information and tickets, check out vim.brownpapertickets.com.
Welcome back to All Access Pass. I'm Spencer Williams, and up next, I will be talking about sexuality and cognitive abilities. Talking about sexuality and cognitive abilities is even less common than conversations about physical disabilities and sexuality. A lot of the research we found is written towards an audience of people interacting with someone with a cognitive disability. Not the first person testimony, and some of what was said came across as sometimes condescending. To counter this, it's important to remember that people with cognitive disabilities have the same sexual needs and desires as those without disabilities, and many want to pursue sexual relationships, marriage, and having a family. In our research, we saw a lot of literature that emphasized the importance of sex education for youth who have cognitive disabilities, and the importance of an open dialogue on the topic of sexuality. Social cues and context and sexual boundaries are nuanced. That may be harder for those with cognitive disabilities to pick up on, which is why the open dialogue is important. It's also important to provide education the people who make up the community of a person with a cognitive disability. The accuracy of information shared on this topic of cognitive disabilities and sexuality is extremely important. As many times, it has a strong influence on how parents, caregivers, and teachers treat the topic of sexuality. Misinformation or misconceptions can lead to infantilization and biased. Infantilization is treating someone in a condescending way as if they are still a young child.
On a different note of sexuality and cognitive disabilities, we came across some startling statistics showing high rates of sexual abuse. One of the statistics I read reported stats that as much as 80% of women who have a cognitive disability and 50% of men who have cognitive disabilities will be abused before the age of 18. This is a topic that deserves further conversations and is a serious issue of safety around sex and disability.
Hi, this is Katie again, and I think that the comments mentioned above, most recently by Spencer, in addition to all of that information, lend further support to the erroneous notion that there is a lack of control or ability to lead normal sexual lives when somebody has a disability. And this leads to these individuals being targeted because they appear to be more vulnerable than individuals without physical or cognitive disabilities. And bouncing off of that, especially with perceptions surrounding disability, I am going to do a little bit of visualization with you all. So close your eyes and picture an individual who is about to have a baby. Their belly may be large and round. They might have long hair or short hair. They might be wearing a billowy dress or a button-up shirt with space for their swollen stomach. And maybe they're with their partner. What does their partner look like? Were these people sitting in a wheelchair? Did either of them take medication for mental illness? Probably not. Sexuality and sex do not have to lead to pregnancy, and they're not inherently tied together, but pregnancy is a related subject that deserves attention in the realm of physical and cognitive abilities and the misconceptions associated with its presence there. I read a story online told by a woman named Erin Andrews, a rehabilitation psychologist who is a triple amputee and, at the time of the publication, very near to being a new mom. Her story tells of her experience navigating the healthcare system in preparation for her pregnancy and highlights the problems that it seems many women with disabilities face. Suspicion over her ability to be a parent and her ability to give birth because of her disability. According to a website called disabledparents.net, around 8 million families in the U.S. have a parent with a disability. So this is a relevant topic that I don't think we consider when we're thinking about new parents and pregnancy and children in general. So some of the misconceptions that I am aware of and have discovered more in depth doing research for this topic include some of the following. If somebody is physically disabled, they will not be able to bear or give birth to a child. This is following the questions that many might have about how a disabled individual became pregnant in the first place, connected to the assumptions of asexuality and lack of desirability. So in addition to being pregnant or having a baby and the questions that surround your ability to be a parent after that, people might even be wondering, like, how did you become pregnant in the first place? Somebody, like, having a partner is tied into all of that and is included in those misconceptions. Another being individuals with disabilities have high risk, quote unquote, pregnancies. The aforementioned article described the author's experience being treated as a, quote unquote, high risk pregnancy by many practitioners before finding the right doctor for her that affirmed her own belief that she was not high risk in any way. Despite her disability, her pregnancy was not going to be a concern. She did mention some of the physical challenges that she faced, being being a triple amputee in her wheelchair as her body changed with the pregnancy, she did have to have some accommodations made with having a more comfortable cushion for her chair, having more assistance when she's transitioning from her chair to a bed or to another chair to sit in. But the actual pregnancy component of that experience was not risky. Pregnant individuals with disabilities being selfish and taking government money as a result of their disability and becoming a parent. Erin Andrews found support in online forums that connected women with other women who had gone through pregnancy, birth, and child rearing while also having a disability. And she really appreciated having this community. But other comments that she found online were more frustrating for her to see, such as highlighting the assumptions that the public has about how it is selfish to have a child if you have a disability, and that the possible financial aid afforded by the government as a result of having a disability and a child. Other comments referred to these women and their children as burdens as a result of some of this financial aid, and assumed that the mothers would not be able to properly care for their children because of their disabilities, and thought that it was selfish to bring a child into the world for that reason, which is obviously in the misconception section. So I wanted to highlight some of the realities that I found online related to this subject as well. Individuals can bear and give birth to children if they have a disability, but the challenges are often in the actual medical and healthcare system. Testimonies that I saw online by women regarding the challenges of navigating the healthcare system, with medical staff assuming they should not be having children or that their pregnancies are risky. According to my research and reading about individuals' experiences with pregnancy and disability, it appears that doctors are trained to treat disability as an exception to the rule and not a norm when it comes to performing basic medical examinations, tests, and navigating a pregnancy with a patient. Like any pregnant individual, needs and conditions of pregnancy are diverse, and doctors should not be trained to expect pregnant bodies to look a certain way, only to find out that they are hugely diverse in their abilities. Not all pregnant people are going to look the same, and there should be an expectation that a different kind of pregnant body might come into your medical office, and you should be prepared for that and not think of it as the exception to the rule. Individuals who are pregnant and have cognitive disabilities may require additional support from specialized practitioners in some cases, but assumptions about someone's ability to become pregnant or to be a good parent should not impact a doctor's treatment of that patient. And like I mentioned before about some of the different physical accommodations that needed to be made for Erin Andrews in her article, there are additional physical barriers, such as one that she discussed being the high tables in examination rooms. As she became more pregnant, she was 2 weeks away from having her baby at the time the article was published. And she said that as she became more pregnant and her body changed and she became heavier, it became more and more difficult to transition out of her chair onto the high tables because they didn't have adjustable heights on them, which seems like it, as we make the world slightly more physically accessible to individuals, you would think that an adjustable table, especially in a medical setting, would exist for people that can't necessarily walk or stand up or lift themselves onto a table. Because Erin Andrews, being a triple amputee, had one arm, and she's not going to be able to lift herself onto a table, especially when she's pregnant. A pregnant body is expected to be able to do certain things, and the world is not always designed to support those that don't fit into that mold. Disability in parenting is often seen as a quote-unquote child protection issue as well. One testimony by a woman named Charlie Fuchs, who has psoriatic arthritis, described her experience of approaching her doctor to explain that she was pregnant, and the doctor assumed that she wanted to arrange a termination of her pregnancy before she could even continue the conversation. And I read about a few parents' testimonies saying that when they became pregnant, a lot of people expressed concern surrounding their ability to care for the child and maybe not wanting to become a parent as a result of their disabilities. Parents with disabilities are not always the ones who actually give birth to their children as well. Many parents are stigmatized due to a disability, even if they're not the ones who bear and give birth to the child. I read an article by a man named Tim Rushby Smith, and he discussed his experience with a spinal cord injury that left him paralyzed just 5 months before he became a father. He had to adjust his own expectations of what it meant to be a dad, as well as others around him who needed to adjust their expectations about what being a dad meant and how he would care for his child now that he wasn't able to walk. He also found a lot of support in online communities and was the source for some of the other testimonies that I read about and mentioned. And I would encourage you to go read his article, because thinking about pregnancy and disability, it's not always the person that's pregnant with the disability, and there's a lot of stigma surrounding parenting in general when you have some sort of physical or cognitive impairment. Related to cognitive disability, it was really challenging to find any information on pregnancy and cognitive disability that wasn't in the form of research being done on the topic and essentially making those individuals the subject of research that then had results presented to an audience that wasn't necessarily designed for those individuals. I took a research course this year that really highlighted the importance, especially with marginalized populations. If you're going to go into a community and do research, especially if you're not somebody that's inherently tied to that community, and have some way to give back once you've done that research. And a lot of these articles looked like they might have had assumptions going in, and they were looking to prove them, and that's what they had in the end. So I don't want to highlight any of those articles. I was hoping for, like Spencer said, more first-person testimony and information targeted towards educating individuals that might have cognitive disabilities and challenges and relate that to sexuality. But it's not something I could find related to pregnancy. This entire thing is a stigmatized subject that needs to be normalized by everyone, but perhaps first and foremost by the healthcare system, so that parents can, at the very least, expect support for their medical needs throughout their pregnancy from those that are going to be practicing the medicine with them. Oh, that got me a little bit worked up. So I think a music break would be good now. Let that sink in. I hope that visualization allowed you to shift your mindset a little bit and that you're thinking about everything we've talked about now. Let that sink in while we listen to Julian Baker and Sprained Ankle.
Spilling my guts, sweat on a micro. Does Discorder magazine summon Discord?
Only the good kind. This month, we feature musicians and artists sifting through chaos to form distinct creative practices and personas. Flip through the pages of Discorder for Mass Marriage, Iceberg Ferg, Plazas, Phono Pony, the Jamie and Sarah Experience Project, and more. This month also features artwork by Aaron Moran, live show reviews of Julia Holter and Parquet Courts, and album reviews for You Say Party and Joe Past. We'd also like to thank our advertisers, Vancouver Theatre Sports, Vinyl Records, Rickshaw, Center for Digital Media, Dead Offensive Records, The Rio Theatre, Vinyl Records, LiveAnn.com, and AMS Events.
Oh, man.
What?
I really wanted to catch that football game, but I have to clean my room. I'm so bummed.
Yo, man, totally chill out. You can catch it on CITR.
CITR?
Did someone say CITR?
Yeah.
CITR Radio brings you Thunderbird Sports on the weekends. Catch all the action and don't miss a moment of play with our live play-by-play and color commentary. Only on CITR 101.9 FM.
Wow, that's great.
And if you can't catch the game, tune in at 3:30 p.m. every Thursday for our weekly update on UBC Athletics with live scores, recaps, and in-depth analysis.
Oh, okay, dude, we get it.
Dude!
Only on CITR.
Get your midweek Roots music fix every Wednesday evening with Folk Oasis, featuring the latest releases from Canadian and especially BC artists, as well as phone interviews and live studio sets with local and touring artists. Folk Oasis, two eclectic hours of Roots music, always a Kumbaya free zone. Wednesday evenings from 8 to 10 p.m. on CITR-FM 101.9, and www.citr.ca.
Got a pocket full of prayers to spare. Thank you.
You're listening to All Access Pass on CITR 101.9 FM. My name is Naheed Jadavji. And you were just listening to Hector by Cold Specs. On today's show, we've been addressing the topic of sex and disability, and I'm going to be speaking to the curriculum aspects at university that address these topics. At the Gender, Race, Sexuality, and Social Justice Institute at UBC, both the major and minor GRSJ degrees and the minor offered in critical studies and sexuality lack courses that focus on disabilities and accessibility exclusively. As a GRSJ major, I have found that we have discussed accessibility in classes, but not with the breadth and depth necessary to truly encompass communities of folks with disabilities, and thus we cannot truly understand systemic oppressions specific to this subject. When talking about sexuality, specifically and relating it to this week's show, general systems of oppression of misogyny and homophobia, transphobia, and the sexualization of certain bodies in negative ways are highlighted, taught, learned, and discussed. However, the intricacies of varying physical and mental disabilities in relation to sexuality are not covered in the curriculum. There are definitely courses offered on learning more about varying abilities and disabilities, both physical, with degrees like kinesiology, and mental, with cognitive systems and psychology. However, it is still talked about from a medical point of view. Case studies and information are presented. However, humanizing individuals and communities and focusing on sexuality and disability, as well as the various ways that can look in terms of sexual identity, orientation, feelings and desires, all of these aspects are not focused on. And the area that you would expect to find these conversations, a social justice major or degree, we see that these topics are missing from the syllabi. It is important to include courses on disability, and not only just for the sake of inclusion, where we have only 1 week incorporating these themes, but full courses taught and also led by folks with disabilities. It is important for universities and all places of learning to involve and include communities of varying abilities. It is important for students with disabilities to see themselves reflected in what we learn and should be learning about in the world. Not only is that important, but it is also crucial for people going into social work to have the opportunities to focus on accessibility, to receive foundations at undergraduate levels, and to understand accessibility better. To have more people being more aware, alert, and attuned to accessibility is only beneficial. For us to have more trained professionals in the world of accessibility is important, and we need to begin having courses at universities which are valued places of knowledge production and learning, to incorporate this knowledge too, and to make the world more accessible. Up next, we'll have another song, Not Up to Me by Candle.
Welcome back to All Access Pass on CITR 101.9 FM. I'm Molly McAllister. We're just about out of time in tonight's episode, so we want to remind you to turn your dials back in next Thursday for another episode of All Access Pass, Thursday at 5 o'clock. Today we took a bird's eye view looking at the topic of sexuality and disability, and you heard from all our collective members on different issues within this topic. Next week we're going to be zeroing in and looking specifically at particular issues with some interviews to share with you, so you should definitely tune back in because we think you'll really like that. Up next on air on CITR is Are You Aware? And we're going to leave you with a song. So here is Hot Dad Calendar by Kate Tana.